ID and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, 5 special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. Don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Pereira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Discover the full program on festivalnuitafrique.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Leaders at this year's African Union Summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, have condemned Israel's assault on Gaza and called for its immediate end. The chair of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki, on Saturday, said Israel's offensive was, quote, the most flagrant violation of international humanitarian law, and accused Israel of having, quote, exterminated Gaza's residents. Meanwhile, Azali Assoumani, president of the Comoros and the outgoing chairperson of the African Union, praised the case brought by South Africa against Israel at the International Court of Justice, where the court ruled there's plausible case that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. During last year's AU summit, an Israeli delegate was removed from the plenary hall amidst a disagreement over Israel's observer status at the African Union. For more, we're joined by Nanjala Niebola, a writer and political analyst from Kenya, joining us from London. Thank you so much for being with us, Nanjala. If you can start off on Gaza, this meeting this past weekend in Ethiopia, where you even had Lula, the president of Brazil, coming to address the group and saying that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza, whereupon Israel's prime minister said that Lula is persona non grata in Israel. But talk about the significance of the meeting on Gaza, and then we'll move on to other issues.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Amy. I think it's important to understand that the African Union, as a bloc, has been a consistent supporter of Palestinian rights since 1972 and arguably since 1948. Many of African nations see similarities between, and they see really an identical experience between Palestinian occupation and what they have endured as under colonization. And so there's a lot of empathy there, and there's a lot of resonance there. It's important, though, to distinguish the position of the African Union from the position of individual member states. So while the union itself has been consistent and has always held the line that Palestinian independence was an integral part of the African Union's foundational documents and foundational position in international relations, various African nations, because there is no impetus from the African Union for there to be always a single position within each country, various African nations do have different relationships with both Israel and Palestine. So, for example, while every single country in Africa except one recognizes the state of Palestine, the recognition of the state of Israel has varied. There was a time in after the 1972 war where African nations wholesale declared that they would not recognize the state of Israel, but that has changed considerably. Similarly, in relation to the African Union itself, the Palestinian territories have had observer status at the African Union since 2013. And so you mentioned how the Israeli representative of the African to the African Union was asked to leave the meeting of the African Union in 2022. This is really because there's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not the African Union as a body should recognize Israel as a observer. Observers do not get to vote, obviously, on various issues that are before the African Union, but they do get to participate in meetings, and they do get to contribute to conversations in some ways. And so it is an important thing to be an observer at the African Union, and Israel has made significant diplomatic inroads in this regard. But the position of the African Union, which is the head of states, the meeting of the head of states is the most senior decision-making entity within the African Union, as opposed to the commission, which oversees the day-to-day running of the organization. The position of the African Union heads of states has always been that Israel did not have that observer status, and this was the back and forth, that the commission had taken an action that the union itself had not endorsed, and this is why the Israeli representative was asked to leave. This remains a position of contention, and the increase of the violence in Gaza has only made it clear that the African Union is going to remain with the historical position, which is recognition of the Palestinian territories and a demand that there is adherence to international law on the issue of Palestine, and that includes the occupation, predates October 7th, goes all the way back to every single UN resolution that has been passed on the issue to date. That's the official African Union position, and what we've seen in this last week is a reinforcement of that position, a reification of that position.
Nangela Nyabola, you've spoken in the past about Namibia, which before Palestine was the last country where international law on occupation was tested. South Africa occupied Namibia until 1994. What were the lessons here, and how did they shape the knowledge of the terrain of occupation and its impact on people being occupied?
Well, it's really been one of the most interesting developments in international relations in relation to Gaza, is that we're finally seeing this recollection of the fact that African connection with Palestine, A, is not a new thing, and there's been a long history of solidarity and support with liberation movements, particularly the ANC in South Africa and SWAPO in Namibia. So as you mentioned, Namibia was an occupied territory, was occupied by the apartheid government of South Africa until 1994. And SWAPO and the ANC both worked together to end that occupation, but also collaborated with the Palestinian Liberation Authority, Palestinian Liberation Organization, to try and coordinate whether it was a political support at the international level, which was a crucial element of ending that, but also through the trusteeship mechanism. Namibia was under the UN trusteeship commission, through the trusteeship mechanism, trying to find ways of negotiating independence for Namibia and protecting Namibia from further South African incursions. South African apartheid government's relationship with its neighbors was always fraught. There were frequent bombing campaigns that happened in Botswana. There was fighting in Mozambique and in Namibia. And so there was always this tension between the apartheid government and governments in the region. And so Palestine, in that regard, becomes a natural ally because that experience of occupation is very similar. And so when we saw at the ICJ this week, the Palestinian submission to the ICJ, there was this recollection of the fact that SWAPO and ANC have always been allies of Palestinian liberation. And what we're seeing with this Palestinian reinforcement of international law is not a new occurrence. It's something that South Africa and Namibia both learned keenly through the process of fighting for independence and the end of apartheid, and they would like to see it replicated in the way the Palestinian issue is handled at the international level. And that is, once again, this is what stick to the letter of the law, because this law exists for a reason, and this law came through for Namibia. Can it provide the same protection for Palestinian people?
Very interesting that at the International Court of Justice yesterday, in this six-day hearing that's taking place, where more than a quarter of the UN's countries, it's the largest gathering ever, will be speaking against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Namibia spoke, of course, South Africa, which has brought this other case around the genocide case against Israel. And also you have the U.S. vetoing the UN Security Council resolution yesterday for a ceasefire that was brought by Algeria, a country that was occupied by France by more than a century. Nangela, if you could address that and then move on to the DRC and the issues raised there around the warring that's going on in eastern Congo, and particularly around Rwanda's role with the M23.
So one of the important things to remember is that diplomatically, at the international level, African countries are the most cohesive voting bloc, certainly at the United Nations, but in other international forums. And this is because, again, as I mentioned, the African Union mechanisms for deliberation are actually incredibly strong. When there is an African line on an issue, there's a lot of negotiation that precedes that. But countries tend to vote by the line, and there tends to be very much a consistent diplomatic front. And this is one reason why Israel, for example, has tried very hard to make inroads with the diplomatic community in Africa, because on all of the votes that have come down the General Assembly that have consistently criticized Israel, even at the Security Council, anything that's managed to get through that has criticized Israel, African countries have consistently voted in favor of these resolutions. And so there is actually this bigger issue of numbers. You know, we tend to think about power in international relations in terms of military strength and in terms of financial strength. But what Africa has at the international level is just sheer numbers. We're talking about 54 countries that have a very interconnected view of history and tend to work together and cooperate together and bring those numbers together for all of these international votes. And so Algeria is a big country on the continent, even though it might not seem that way externally. But Algeria has been one of the most consistent defenders of Palestinian liberation on the continent, came out very strongly against Israeli diplomatic presence at the AU, came out very strongly in favor of Palestinian independence and supporting the Palestinian liberation organizations. And so it's not a surprise to see that Algeria at the Security Council would take this very strong position, because it is very consistent with Algerian diplomatic history. And as you said, it is because Algeria has endured several, you know, decades of French occupation that culminated in one of the most violent wars of independence that we've really ever seen globally. And, you know, France is still in the process of trying to make reparations for this, because for Algerians, it remains a very sore spot in history, and it remains to be a very, you know, fraught question between Franco-Algerian relationships. So I'm not surprised to see Algeria bring this resolution forward, just like, you know, as you've probably heard from American analysts, you know, it was not a surprise that the UN voted, even though it was a disappointment, that the US voted in the way that it did. And I think we're going to expect to see a lot more coordinated action being led by nations like Algeria, South Africa, all of these countries that have historically supported Palestinian liberation in Africa will continue to toe this line, because it is not just a question of it's a question of history. It's a question of solidarity. It's a question of shared experiences of all of these systemic types of violence.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
We go now to The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is holding a six-day hearing as over 50 countries are testifying against Israel's occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. It's the largest ever participation in world courts history. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki said Monday, quote, "The genocide underway in Gaza is a result of decades of impunity and inaction." Riyad Mansour, Palestinian envoy to the UN, delivered emotional testimony Monday.
The state of Palestine appeals to this court to guide the international community in upholding international law, ending injustice, and achieving a just and lasting peace. To guide us towards a future in which Palestinian children are treated as children. Not as demographic threat, in which the identity of the group to which we belong does not diminish the human rights to which we are all entitled. A future in which no Palestinian and no Israelis is killed. A future in which two states live side by side in peace and security. The Palestinian only people only demand respect for their rights. They ask for nothing more. They cannot accept nothing less and nothing else. The future of freedom, justice, and peace can begin here and now.
That was Palestine's permanent representative to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, addressing the International Court of Justice Monday. Earlier today, South African Ambassador Vusi Madonsela addressed the court.
The inordinate delay in achieving a fair and just settlement has resulted in an unending cycle of violence. A clear legal characterization of the nature of Israel's regime over the Palestinian people can only assist in remedying the ongoing delay in achieving a just settlement. We as South Africans sense, see, hear, and feel to our core the inhumane discriminatory policies and practices of the Israeli regime as an even more extreme form of the apartheid that was institutionalized against black people in my country.
For more, we're joined from The Hague, where the ICJ hearing is taking place, by Ahmed Aboufoul, legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq. He contributed to their advisory opinion on the case. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is historic, what's taking place right now, Ahmed, at the International Court of Justice. More than half the world's countries are participating in this. Talk about the significance of this. And although we just played the South African envoy's comments, this is not to be confused with that other case, the South Africa bringing the case around genocide against Israel in the court that just happened a few weeks ago.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me again, Amy, and congratulations on Democracy Now!'s 28th anniversary. In this dystopian age of misinformation and biased media, especially in the West, we value your work and we congratulate you and hope your viewer will continue to support your important work. You're absolutely right, Amy. This is a historical moment. For over 57 years, Israel has been perpetuating its occupation in the occupied Palestinian territories, dominating every aspect of their lives, and maintaining this occupation to further facilitate and impose this apartheid regime imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole. One of the important features of this occupation is that it is colonial in nature. So it's combined with the continued unabated building of settlements and the theft of land and the demographic manipulation and engineering of the occupied Palestinian territory in an attempt to empty it from its indigenous people. A very common feature of colonial regimes and projects trying to steal the land without the people. This is a historical moment, Amy, because this is, as you mentioned, the case with the most interest by states in the history of the advisory opinion procedure before the court. And it shows you that the world have something to say about this occupation. The whole body of occupation, of the law of occupation, shows us that occupation was not intended to last that long. Occupation is temporary in nature. But the way Israel perpetrated the occupations shows that Israel is not interested in ending that occupation, but it actually needs that occupation to further implement its strategy to acquire more land by force with as less Palestinians as possible. And therefore, the premise of this case, I think there are three main legal arguments: that Israel is violating what we call international law, peremptory norms, from which no derogation is permitted. So the first norm that Israel is violating is the acquisition of territory by force or the threat of the use of force. The second is Israel's violations of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, which is also a peremptory norm, and the opposition of regime of racial discrimination and demographic manipulation in the occupied Palestinian territory and beyond. That is a regime of apartheid imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole, denying them their unalienable rights, including Palestinian refugees who continue to be denied their right to return to their homes and villages. So this is an important moment where for the first time, we would have the principal organ of the United Nations telling us the legal consequences of Israel's occupation, and it will be extremely difficult for Israel's allies after that to justify Israel's actions in any way possible. Israel has been instrumentalizing the rules of international humanitarian law, the body of law that governs the situation of occupation, to further its settler colonial project in Palestine. I think after this decision, which I have no doubt that the court will decide that Israel's occupation is illegal, it will be very difficult to support Israel and its policies by Israel's allies, including the U.S. So all eyes on the U.S. and how it will react to this important ruling.
And Ahmed Abu Fola, I wanted to ask you, for those who are not familiar with these international legal bodies, could you briefly summarize the difference between the International Court of Justice proceedings and the separate case that South Africa filed, the complaint of genocide at the International Criminal Court against Israel, especially in terms of the jurisdiction or the powers of the court to have any direct effect on Israel's actions?
Yes, absolutely. I think you meant South Africa's genocide case before the very same court, the International Court of Justice. And these are two different proceedings. The International Court of Justice can look into advisory proceedings where any organ of the United Nations can ask the court to provide a legal opinion on what the court thinks of a certain matter. Usually, such rulings are non-binding for states, but they're of particular importance as they guide the whole United Nations and the member states in how to approach a certain matter or a certain question. The other type of procedure is contentious cases, where states take each other to court when they have a disagreement on a matter of international law. So, for example, a disagreement on the interpretation of a particular convention to which both are parties and have accepted the court's jurisdiction. And that's exactly what South Africa did in the genocide case against Israel on the interpretation of the genocide convention, where it took Israel to court. So it's a case between South Africa and Israel. While in the advisory opinion proceeding, there are no two parties. There's only the court that is deciding on a matter of question, and all states around the world are invited to provide their written statements, their oral interventions, to tell the court what is their position, what is their interpretation of the law on that particular matter. Because international law is made by the practices of these states and what states around the world have accepted to be customary international law and have accepted to be the common interpretation of international law. So the law on occupation, as I said, is clear that the occupation was not intended to last that long and is temporary in nature, but it didn't set any time limit in which occupation has to end. So that's how Israel has been perpetuating this, often described as prolonged occupation. It's the longest occupation in modern history, claiming under the usual security pretext that it needs to continue its control and needs to continue its domination of the Palestinian people and its violations of their perimetry norms.
And what is the role of the public in these cases? Is there any?
Of course, absolutely. The public, you know, don't have a standing in procedure or like civil society organizations, for example, like the one I'm proudly associated with, that is Al-Haq, can always submit to the court, but these submissions are not part of the proceedings. They're available at the seating of the court for states participating in the proceedings, but also for judges to read them and consult them. And we have already published a position paper outlining the key legal arguments in this case and our view on how the court should approach this case. But if you allow me, these rulings are usually of particular importance to be used after. So how, for example, the state in question will utilize this ruling in its diplomatic efforts, whether taking this ruling to the General Assembly to adopt a resolution to the same effect, or perhaps to the Security Council, although there will always be the U.S. Veto. So what comes after that decision, I think, is also of particular importance and historically, the ICJ cases have served in a way to provide guidance on what international law says and how states should behave. Obviously, not always states have listened to such rulings or they tried to disobey them. But for example, in the situation in South Africa and the ruling on the illegal presence of South African apartheid in Namibia, it served and it created momentum for the mobilization on the ground, which eventually led to the end of that regime. So hopefully this advisor opinion is also another step forward to ending Israel's settler colonial and apartheid regime imposed on the Palestinian people as a whole.
Can you talk, Ahmed Aboulful, about the response of the court? This is when it was run by Joan Donahue. And important to point out, she came out of the State Department. She's the head of the International Court of Justice. But she is no longer the head of the Court of Justice. But it was under her, and it was her reading of the preliminary decision around South Africa bringing its genocide case to the court. If you can talk about who's the new head of the court. And then I want to ask you about what just happened in Israel, in the Knesset, voting not to expel Ofer Kassif, the lawmaker who's a member of the Hadash party supporting the genocide case against Israel at the ICJ. I just wanted to play a clip of the Knesset member Kassif speaking to Democracy Now! About facing expulsion, which didn't happen.
They want me and my friends to shut up. They don't want us to raise our voice against any kind of violence. Because as I said million times, as someone who continuously for years object and oppose the Israeli occupation and siege against the Palestinian people, I said explicitly that even the crimes of the siege and the occupation cannot and will never justify the massacre committed by Hamas. We added that the massacre, the criminal massacre by Hamas, cannot justify the massacre and assault of Israel on Gaza, in which around 30,000 people are already dead, were killed. The vast majority, more than 70%, are innocent civilians, around 10,000 children.
So that's a member of the Knesset who remains so because they lost the vote to expel him, Ofer Kassif. And if you can respond to the new president, Nawaf Salam, who's replacing Joan Donahue.
As you said, Judge Nawaf Salam, who is a Lebanese judge, he has been a member of the court since February 2018 and newly elected as president of the court since 6th of February 2024. He is now the president of the court. But if you allow me, whether him or the American judge, judges before the ICJ, they don't serve as agents of their state of nationality. They serve as independent judges who provide their personal views about international law and the interpretation of international law after hearing the positions of the states. So it is not usual to presume that because of the nationality of the president of the court, that the position will be aligned with the foreign policy of the state of that judge. That is not the case, whether American or Lebanese or any other nationality of the president of the court. It is presumed, and the presumption is of their professional way of work and deliver on their mandate in accordance with the law. As to the voting to expel member of Knesset, it also, in my view, it shows you how radicalized Israeli society has become. So even the very tiny minority that you have where Israeli Knesset members are calling for the end of the occupation or calling for the bare minimum of human decency, that is a ceasefire, the rest of Knesset members from the Israeli members are mostly against that. And such tiny minority of those who call for Palestinian rights are often attacked. And as you said, there was an attempt to even remove him from the Knesset. And I think it's very telling to see also how supportive Israeli society has been in the genocide against the Gaza Strip. Amy, we need not to forget that right before the war, the Israeli society mobilized hundreds of thousands in the streets because of Netanyahu's plan to attack the judiciary or to minimize their authority in reviewing government's decision. But when it comes to Palestinians who are being oppressed, who are only a few meters away, the Israeli society somehow is unable to mobilize or call for the end of the occupation. So in a way, it seems that the Israeli society has been radicalized into believing that for them to enjoy the privileges of this apartheid regime, they don't mind the Palestinians being oppressed. And unfortunately, the foreign policy of states that claim to be friends to Israel, I think, have contributed profoundly to such radicalization, simply because they've been ensuring impunity for Israel and Israeli war criminals who have been committing crimes for the past decades. So I think, in a way, the reason that we have such extreme government at the moment, one of the most extreme and right-wing in the history of Israel, which has ministers who are proudly self-described as Islamophobic and homophobes and fascists and racist ministers like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, is a result of, in my view, of the U.S. and European foreign policy ensuring that Israel enjoys an exceptional treatment, that Israel is untouchable. It enjoys prevailing impunity where Israel can commit crimes, but no one is held accountable.
Ahmed, I'm so sorry that, well, when we last spoke, you'd already lost some 60 members of your family born and raised in Gaza. You are. And I wanted to just ask in this 30 seconds, about Benny Gantz's comments, part of the War Council, saying if the hostages are not home by Ramadan, which was like March 10th, the fighting will continue everywhere, including Rafah.
Yeah, well, it shows you also the character and the behavior of Israel. Israel is behaving like a pariah, is behaving like a rogue state, is not listening to anyone, is not listening to its closest allies. Israel needs to have the humility to understand that the Palestinian people are free people, are not colonial subjects. They're entitled to their rights, and Israel at some point will need to sit and listen with seriousness to the and consideration to the aspiration of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, Amy, are not asking for a favor. They're asking for their unalienable basic human rights. And I think the world for long has misunderstood the Palestinians. We're not even asking. We're demanding those rights. We're entitled to those rights, regardless of what Israel think about that.
Ahmed Abu Ful, we want to thank you for being with us, legal research and advocacy officer at the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, speaking to us from The Hague.
Here in the United States, President Biden is urging the House to vote to approve a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed by the Senate Tuesday that includes $14 billion for Israel's war on Gaza, along with $60 billion for Ukraine and $8 billion for Indo-Pacific allies like Taiwan. It also strips U.S. funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders opposed the measure, joined by two Democratic senators who broke ranks with their party, Jeff Merkley and Peter Welch. This is Welch.
I voted against the supplemental for one key reason. I cannot, in good conscience, support sending billions of additional taxpayer dollars for Prime Minister Netanyahu's military campaign in Gaza. It's a campaign that has killed and wounded a shocking number of civilians. It's created a massive humanitarian crisis with no end in sight. It's inflamed tensions in the Middle East, eroding support among Arab states that had been aligned with Israel. And of course, it has severely compromised any remaining hope, almost all remaining hope, for the two-state solution that we all know is ultimately essential for peace in the Middle East.
That's Vermont Senator Peter Welch. The foreign aid package now faces an uncertain future in the Republican-controlled House, where Speaker Mike Johnson's refusing to schedule a vote without first adding new anti-immigrant and border enforcement measures and may propose an alternative package today. For more, we are here in New York with William Hartung, national security foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new piece for Forbes is headlined, Senate Aid Package Underscores Washington's Skewed Priorities. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Bill. Talk about what this bill represents, which is largely supported by Democrats.
Well, the first thing that stuck out to me is $95 billion, most of it to ship weapons overseas into war zones. You know, this Senate would never do an emergency bill to stop record homelessness, stop hunger, deal with the climate crisis. The United States has the worst record of life expectancy of any industrialized country, and yet we're putting the bulk of our resources into implements of war. And, of course, to give Israel more money to continue the slaughter in Gaza that we've seen laid out in this program is obscene. And I think the members who voted for it should be ashamed of themselves. But I think the real point is to stop the killing. There's got to be a ceasefire. And President Biden, through cutting off, conditioning U.S. military aid, has the strongest hand to try to do that. So there's got to be more pressure. I know there's been a lot at the grassroots level, some within the government, but it's got to continue because I think the goal here has to be to stop the slaughter.
And the Senate vote came just hours after the EU's foreign policy chief urged the United States and other countries to stop providing arms to Israel. So if you could respond to that, how common is it, first of all, for the EU foreign policy chief to make such a pronouncement? And whether this kind of pressure will affect the Biden administration's policy?
Well, it's very unusual to see that kind of statement, from an ally. But this is a very unprecedented and devastating situation. So, I don't know what exactly is going to move the president. It's clear it's going to hurt him electorally. It's clear that it's running the risk of a wider Middle East war. There's really no, from a realistic point of view, there's no reason to be doing this. It's basically kind of a ideological kind of issue that seems to be embedded in the president's consciousness that has to be dislodged.
Bill Hartung, you've talked about how the Pentagon and military contractors are exploiting Russia's invasion of Ukraine to get special favors, to push arms out the door without proper vetting, building more factories without oversight. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, the industry has had this long-standing list of things they wanted, as you pointed out. Push arms quickly, less human rights vetting, more subsidies to build factories. And, of course, this reduced scrutiny will also make it easier for them to engage in price gouging. So they've sort of wrapped themselves in the flag with respect to Ukraine. The president has called them the arsenal of democracy, I think, which would be a surprise to the people of Yemen and other places where the U.S. is arming dictatorships. So they're trying to run with this and really change the whole argument about whether we should be spending more on the military at a time when the budget is soaring towards $1 trillion a year. U.S. accounts for 40% of world military spending, more than the next 15 countries combined. So there's got to be strong pushback against this because essentially it's kind of a new Cold War atmosphere and its attempt to kind of whitewash the negative consequences of what these companies do. And, of course, contractors get about half of that close to $1 trillion a year that we spend on the military.
Finally, if President Biden says he's warning Israel, for example, against a ground invasion of Rafah, but then increasing funding to Israel and military funding, what message is that sending?
Well, I think anything this administration says about human rights, the rule of law, the rules-based international order rings hollow in the face of what's happening with respect to supporting Israel in this war. And I think it'll reverberate well beyond this conflict. I think, the U.S. will not be taken as seriously when they raise these kinds of issues in the future. So not only is it horrific for the people of Gaza, but I think it undermines the role of the United States in the world in any cases where they actually would want to play a constructive role. So it's hard to manage a more damaging foreign policy decision.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Gaza, to Israel threatening to launch a ground invasion of Rafah, where over a million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. On Monday, President Biden hosted King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House. During public remarks, Biden initially described Israel's operation in Rafah as, quote, our operation.
Yesterday, our military operation in Rafah, the major military operation in Rafah, should not proceed without a credible plan for ensuring the safety and support of more than 1 million people sheltering there.
Jordan's King Abdullah condemned Israel's plan to attack Rafah and called for a ceasefire and the creation of a Palestinian state.
We cannot afford an Israeli attack on Rafah. It is certain to produce another humanitarian catastrophe. The situation is already unbearable for over 1 million people who have been pushed into Rafah since the war started. We cannot stand by and let this continue. We need a lasting ceasefire now. This war must end. 7 decades of occupation, death, and destruction have proven beyond any doubt that there can be no peace without a political horizon. Military and security solutions are not the answer. They can never bring peace. Civilians on both sides continue to pay for this protracted conflict with their lives.
We go now to Toronto, where we're joined by Dr. Yasser Khan. He's a Canadian ophthalmologist and eye surgeon who recently returned from a humanitarian surgical mission at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Dr. Khan, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can describe what you saw there in Khan Yunis, the level of the injuries, how crowded the European hospital was, the threats people were facing there.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, you know, I look at the impending invasion of Rafah and the attacks on Rafah, and I know, because I've seen it, I know what's going to happen. I know the casualties, and I know how much worse it's going to get. When I was in Khan Yunis a few weeks ago, I've been to over 40 different countries, you know, doing humanitarian work anywhere from in Africa, Asia, and South America. And there, what I saw in Khan Yunis were the most horrific scenes in my entire life, and I hope I never see them again. It was just, you know, the bombings were going on every few hours at that point in time. The Israeli forces were about a kilometer away, and the mass casualties kept on coming in. And it was mostly, I mean, the majority of the patients that I treated were children, anywhere from the age of 2 to 17. I mean, I saw horrific eye and facial injuries that I've never seen before. Eyes shattered in 2 6-year-old children with shrapnel that I had to take out. Eyes with shrapnel stuck inside. Facial injuries. I saw orthopedic injuries where, you know, limbs just cut off and dangling. I saw abdominal injuries that were just horrific, and it was just mass chaos. There's children on the floor, unattended to, with head trauma, people suturing patients without anesthesia on the ground. It was just mass chaos and really horrific, horrific scenes. And I know that now with the bombing going on in Rafah and scenes of children hanging, exploded, and, you know, half their bodies cut off and hanging on a wall because they've been exploded. I mean, those are scenes going on now, so I know exactly what my colleagues are going through right now in Rafah and in Gaza, basically.
And doctor, you were working shifts of 12 to 13-hour days. Can you talk about the conditions of the medical staff and the doctors you worked alongside with? Where did you sleep? How were you able to eat? Can you talk about those conditions you faced?
Well, the doctors were amazing. I mean, the Palestinian doctors were amazing. Their dedication and their will to to resist dying, and staying alive was amazing. They're very talented, but they have nothing. There was no antibiotics. There was no painkillers. On the last day I was leaving, we ran out of morphine, which is very important in a lot of orthopedic injuries. So patients were, the whole European Gaza hospital was at the time. Now it's everything I'm seeing, everything I saw is much worse now. But basically, it was overcrowded, about 300-400% over capacity. There's patients and bodies lying all over the hospital floor, inside and outside. They had orthopedic devices coming from their legs or their arms. They're getting infected. They're in pain because they're on the floor, so the conditions weren't very sterile. And if they survived amputation the first time, the infection would get them because then they'd have to be amputated after. A lot of the kids that I saw, and more than 60% of the patients I saw were children. They're thin. They had no fat on them. They're starving because, as you know, Israel has had a food blockade since this war on Gaza started. And so they're all thin with no fat, starving, and they're coming in. And, we didn't have enough supplies, enough gauze, enough antibiotics, enough instruments even. The instruments are rusting to kind of, you know, deal with the mass trauma.
Dr.
I stayed in the hospital.
Yeah. Dr. Han, this is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland speaking Monday ahead of a vote on the $95 billion aid package to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
Madam President, I want that to sink in. Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals.
That's Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Dr. Han, you're talking about the thinness of the children, of the whole population.
Yeah, well, you know, Amy, it's, you know, from what I saw and what I experienced when I was on the ground speaking to officials, speaking to the doctors there, and this whole, you know, one of the whole aspects of this war in Gaza, you know, the genocidal intent of Israeli politicians, the Israeli army, has been clear. What is really bizarre is they haven't hit it. They have openly called for it. They've openly called for epidemics. And so, as a healthcare professional, the attack on the healthcare system has been unprecedented. I mean, the viciousness of it, the killing machine that Israel has unleashed on the healthcare system, I think is unprecedented. Hospitals have been bombed. When the doctors have tried to repopulate them, they've been, you know, sniper fire with drones has prevented them from going in. They've attacked the sewage system, the water system, so the sewage mixes with the drinking water, and you get diarrheal diseases, bacterial diseases. You know, cholera, typhoid is not far away. Hepatitis A is epidemic there now. They're living in cramped spaces. They have killed over 300 or 400 healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, paramedics, ambulances have been bombed. This has all been a systematic sort of, by destroying the healthcare system, you're contributing to the genocide. What's going on is now there's 10 to 15,000 bodies that are decomposing. So it's raining season right now in Gaza. So all the rainwater mixes with the decomposing bodies, and that bacteria mixes with the drinking water supply, and you get further disease. They have kidnapped about 40-45 doctors that have been specifically targeted. They've targeted specifically specialists who are, you know, one-off. So like the one nephrologist in the Gaza Strip was targeted. The pathologist, hospital chiefs and directors have all been targeted through drones or targeted missile strikes. And, you know, so the whole thing is that if the bombings are not going to get you, then disease will surely get you because they're all malnourished. So as you know, if you're malnourished, your immune system is weaker, so you're more susceptible to disease, but there's no antibiotics. You know, the amount of amputations I saw, in children, for example, both arms, one arm, one leg, both eyes gone. you know, both eyes amputated basically out of their eye socket. You know, it's amazing. I mean, it takes about, you know, if this was done properly in a non-war scenario, you know, one amputation in a child will need about 9 to 12 surgeries by the time they're an adult, you know, for prosthetic fitting and whatnot. Now, in this case, first of all, it's a war situation. They've not been done properly, fair enough, because you have to rush it. But secondly, who's going to take care of these children, mostly children, because their parents are gone, their uncles are dead, their grandfathers and grandmothers are dead. And so, you know, the Israeli killing machine has been vicious. I mean, they've used drones. When I was there, I was speaking to doctors who were there, and they told me that they've used drones like the Hellfire drone that is an explosive drone. It fires off these discs once it implodes or explodes, and these discs are very unique, and they cause unique amputations. Most amputations occur at the weak points, like, you know, like the elbow or the knee, but they cause, you know, mid-thigh, mid-arm amputations, which are much more complicated. And they fire off the shrapnel. And, you know, from what the doctors are telling me, that, you know, what I believe is that they're using weapons on the civilian population that have never been used before. Because from what I heard, based on my experience, you know, Israel has a very strong defense industry. And buyers like weapons that are battle-tested. So if you can put a label to a new weapon that's battle-tested, that increases the value of it. And they're experimenting with these weapons from what I've heard and from what I saw in a civilian dense population. So it's just, it's been vicious, really, really vicious.
Amidst worsening hunger, UNICEF is warning that the war-torn territory is, quote, poised to witness an explosion in preventable child deaths, which would compound the already unbearable level of child deaths, unquote. On Monday, Palestinians rushed to get sacks of flour from a UN distribution center in Gaza City. This is a displaced Palestinian named Abdullah Sawaf.
Because we want to eat, we are dying of hunger. Why would someone put himself at risk of dying by coming here? It is in order to feed the children. We are dying of hunger, and there is no food or drink left in Gaza. There is a famine.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces reportedly opened fire again at crowds waiting for humanitarian aid. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Dr. Irfan Galeria, a plastic and reconstructive surgeon just back from volunteering in Gaza with the humanitarian aid group MedGlobal. His L.A. Times op-ed headlined, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war, it was annihilation." Welcome to Democracy Now, doctor. Explain what you saw, why you call it an annihilation.
Certainly. Amy and Juan, thank you so much for having me on the show, and congratulations on 28 years. Look, I understand in war, you're going to have collateral civilian casualties. You'll have displaced citizens. But what I saw when I was in Gaza and what my team saw was vastly different. What we saw was a collateral humanitarian crisis of an unimaginable scale. Over 1 million civilians struggling to survive, struggling to find shelter, struggling to find food, struggling to find drinking water. And what we also saw, what appeared to be a deliberate attempt to strangulate these civilians. We saw, while we were driving to Rafah, miles of trucks lining the road on the Egyptian side waiting to enter. You know, Amy and Juan, what's a very telling statistic is before this war began, almost 500 to 600 aid trucks would cross through the borders daily. It shows you how dependent this country was on aid, even before the war. But now, after the war, or during the war, the need is even greater, and less than 100 trucks are allowed to enter. What I also saw, and what our team also saw, was a deliberate attempt to incapacitate the healthcare system. The healthcare system in Gaza has collapsed. Hospitals have been targeted. They no longer have the physical capacity or space to care for their patients. Physicians are being killed. Healthcare workers are being killed. They're being targeted. They're being imprisoned. There's no medical aid or medical equipment that's coming through. You know, we operated under unsterile conditions, and we had outcomes and procedures that we had to perform in Gaza unfortunately, because we didn't have access to basic medical equipment and aid. And the last thing I would like to add is, while they're facing this humanitarian crisis, they're facing a relentless attack, bombs and missiles regularly. And to me and to my team, there did not seem to be a distinction between any military, soldier, terrorist targets versus civilian targets. The stories we heard over and over again were the same. We took care of patients and civilians that were sleeping in their homes. I'll give you one example. There was a young child, he was 14 years old, a boy who I had taken care of. He sustained what's called an open fracture on his left leg. He lost so much flesh that his bone that was fractured was exposed. His story was that he lived in Khan Yunis, and they went to a local school trying to seek shelter with other families. That school was bombed, and his entire family was killed, and he was orphaned. So there seems to be a deliberate attempt to target civilians, and there doesn't seem to be a very reasonable attempt to protect them in this conflict.
And Dr. Galaria, you wrote in your L.A. Times piece, I couldn't help thinking that the lucky ones died instantaneously, either by the force of the explosion or being buried in the rubble. The survivors faced hours of surgery and multiple trips to the operating room. Could you talk about some more about the conditions under which you performed surgery while you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in war zones. I've operated in small hospitals in Africa. I thought I was going to be prepared, but I was not prepared for what I saw here in terms of not only the equipment and materials that I had access to, but the patients that I was taking care of. We lacked, as surgeons in the hospital then, basic equipment and basic materials, such as sterile drapes, basic surgical equipment. There are a lot of procedures that we couldn't perform because we didn't have access to that equipment. And as a result, patients suffered because we couldn't provide them with procedures or services that we could have provided for them here in America.
Dr. Irfan Galaria, we have to end the conversation here, but we're going to continue online at democracynow.org. People can hear and watch our web exclusive. Dr. Galaria is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He wrote an L.A. Times op-ed headlined, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war. It was annihilation."
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you're calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider.